disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradiobreathing.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 19th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. From the opinion page by Walter Russell Mead, Constantine's Example for China. The Roman Emperor ended the persecution of Christians. Will Beijing follow suit? No political party on earth is as powerful, strong, or wise as the Chinese Communist Party, according to its spokespeople. But there are cracks in the facade. Despite surging exports and tech investment, China's economy isn't doing well, the Wall Street Journal reported Monday. The urban unemployment rate has reached 5.2%. Property investment, once an important driver of China's economic miracle, is down 19% year on year as the real estate bubble continues to deflate. At 4.3%, economic growth has fallen to levels last seen during the pandemic. One bright spot in the current data points to more problems down the road. Exports surged 23.9% in the 12 months from July 2025, but that will only heighten concerns about China Shock 2.0 that have economies all over the world contemplating draconian restrictions on Chinese trade. It is clear to many in China, as it is to your Global View columnist, that China's major problems today are the consequences of Communist Party initiatives gone tragically wrong. Mao Zedong's brutal and misguided policies delayed China's modernization by 40 years. The ill-advised one-child policy created a demographic disaster. And the government-orchestrated real estate bubble directed the savings of hundreds of millions of ordinary Chinese into an unsustainable boom whose inevitable collapse left households across the country seething as their wealth melted away. The full consequences of state-driven manufacturing overcapacity have yet to be felt, but the early signs of another deflationary shock, perhaps as serious as the deflation of the real estate bubble, are rippling through the economy. The cost and cynicism, alienation, and despair of the moral hollowing out of a society that requires constant public praise for the party's wisdom, even as people bear the consequences of its blunders, is harder to measure. But Xi Jinping and his colleagues know these costs are real, and they fear the fallout. Communist rule seems secure for now, but an increasingly sophisticated and educated population is unlikely to accept party tutelage forever. And as change approaches, China's burgeoning Christian population is likely to make itself felt. The success of Christianity in China may be the least reported, most important story of our time. When communist rule opened with the expulsion of foreign missionaries, the confiscation of church properties, and the persecution of Christian leaders, China's approximately 3.4 million Christians compose less than 1% of the country's 540 million citizens. After 77 years of intervals of tolerance, alternating with intervals of repression, official statistics acknowledge 44 million registered Christians. These numbers are clearly too low. Independent estimates vary but range between 100 million and 130 million, or between 7% and 9% of the population. By comparison, the Communist Party claims a membership of about 101 million. Observers close to the House Church movement estimate that another 8% to 10% of the population would soon affiliate with Christian churches if government opposition to the religion ended. Those numbers compare to the percentage of Christians in the Roman Empire when the Emperor Constantine ended Rome's persecution of the new faith and offered freedom to all religions. Rome's shift from persecuting Christians to forming partnerships with them helped stabilize a weakened political order and opened a new era in the empire's history. That raises an interesting question for China. As the legitimacy of the communist system fades, will an aspirant for China's leadership someday follow Constantine's example and seek Christian support? Both from patriotism and a concern for social stability, many Chinese Christians would be ready to meet a Chinese Constantine halfway. For now, the party seems more likely to imitate the Emperor Diocletian, who launched the greatest persecution of Christians in Roman history, than the emperor who ended it. After suppressing Tibetan Buddhists and Uyghurs and Kyiv Muslims, intensifying the crackdown on Christianity must seem to some in the party like the logical next step. Previous episodes of persecution have failed. If anything, they have strengthened the churches. Steadfastness in the face of state opposition gives church leaders a legitimacy that compromise party bosses can't match. Should social unrest continue to grow as the party fails to solve China's domestic problems, Christian support could look attractive for leaders attempting to stabilize the country. Those wishing to lead China after Mr. Xi will likely need more wisdom than the writings of Marx and Mao contain, and they will need more support than the ranks of the party can offer. They will have to turn somewhere for help. Unlikely as it may now seem, the path of Constantine may prove the path of least resistance for a new generation of Chinese leaders. How to Cure What Ails American Capitalism, by Gerard Baker. My readers agree socialism isn't the answer, and they offer creative ideas about what to do instead. Column writing is always a joy, but never so than when it becomes a conversation. It's invigorating to receive responses to my weekly musings, even those, very few, composed with such intensity that I can almost see flecks of spittle on the screen. Journal readers are wise, idealistic, and knowledgeable, and almost invariably have insights that contribute more to any subject than I can. So this week, I feel obliged to do something unusual. Use the last column before a summer break to respond to the avalanche of comments generated by my thoughts last week on the state of American capitalism. Almost everyone agrees that socialism is always and everywhere a disaster. Perhaps somewhat unexpectedly from the readers of these pages, though, the vast majority of my correspondents also agreed that American capitalism is malfunctioning, that instead of free market economics modulated by necessary and limited government intervention, we have an economy overly dominated by big companies, exercising and augmenting their power in ways not always consistent with the competitive principles that maximize efficiency, and increasingly exploiting a cozy relationship with government for their own benefit. In short, too much crony capitalism. What's more, most agreed that these market distortions are the main reason for rising public dissatisfaction with the economy. But almost everyone asked the question, which many answered, what do we do about it? Here, drawing on comments from many readers and channeling my own modest ideas, are suggestions to improve how capitalism works. Reinvigorating free markets requires a broad effort to heighten economic competition. This will involve both economic and political reforms. While there are a few dissenters, the overwhelming economic evidence is that much of the U.S. economy has become far more concentrated in the 21st century, with declining competition in most sectors resulting in a smaller number of firms with higher markups, profits, and cost to the consumer. The blunt instrument of antitrust policy can carry risks, including its own harm to consumers. Addressing anti-market practices requires a unified and comprehensive approach across the executive and legislative branches that bends policy toward promoting competition and scrutinizing anti-competitive action and, where necessary, restraining corporate power through merger review, market access, and targeted antitrust enforcement. It also means reforming the tax code. There's an overwhelming case for simplifying the tax system as a whole to create incentives for investment and cutting through the rules that privilege companies big enough to deploy the best paid accountants. The plethora of measures that make up corporate welfare, subsidies, tax breaks, and tax credits should be eliminated. Some estimates put the direct cost of corporate welfare at almost $200 billion a year. The economic benefit of removing it would be greater. Achieving any of this will be difficult while politicians have a comfortable codependence with big business. Incumbents' ever-growing need to raise money to fend off challengers encourages cronyism. There isn't much that can be done about the need for money to win elections, and under Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission 2010, corporations have a First Amendment right to seek to influence politics. But more transparency could help. Formal executive and legislative efforts to scrutinize and publicize the nexus between campaign money and policy wouldn't be difficult. Deeper political reforms might then be needed, especially to the primary system. In an age of intense partisanship, House members in particular have two masters to please: the small minority of base voters who could oust them, and the corporate paymasters who can help them avoid such an outcome. Neither is a good proxy for the interest of the people as a whole. Lest all this sound like a recipe for dirigisme, control by the state, of the sort historically proven to suppress enterprise and innovation, I should add that allowing American capitalism to flourish also means giving it more space by shrinking government. Rising taxation and spending are steadily stifling private enterprise. The economy won't recover its dynamism until entitlements and welfare spending are scaled back to a sustainable level. You can add to the constraints the federal government places on capitalism's potential, the albatrosses of ever-growing public debt, and a central bank wedded to a policy of backstopping every episode of financial excess. The political opportunity was there. The populist revolt that gave us Donald Trump was a chance to reorient the system toward the interest of the people over the economic elites. Sadly, but unsurprisingly, the Republican Party talked a good game while doing little to redress the balance. American capitalism has proved itself the most dynamic in the world. Even today, it is generating faster growth than most other nations, but it isn't perfect or unchanging. Its particular genius has been its ability to adapt and reform as circumstances demand. They're demanding now. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Now for the key articles under Business and Finance. A continuing global bond sell-off is hammering governments, businesses, and families. And while stocks hover near record highs, U.S. indexes wobbled on Tuesday, with the S&P 500, NASDAQ, and Dow falling 0.7%, 1.3%, and 0.2% respectively. Trump said he would pause a new 50% tariff set to go into effect on $20 billion worth of goods from Canada as the two countries seek an agreement. KKR recently bid for UGI, offering roughly $9 billion to take over the Pennsylvania-based natural gas and electricity distributor. OpenAI's second quarter sales showed tepid growth compared with Anthropic's, disappointing some shareholders who had hoped for evidence the gap was closing. Costco plans a limited rollout of Costco-branded Medicare plans, working with nonprofit insurer Scan Group. Homeowners took on smaller spring maintenance projects in the recent quarter, lifting Home Depot sales and encouraging the company to back its full-year outlook. Individuals and firms criticized a Trump administration plan to axe a long-standing rule meant to ensure that investors get the best price when trading stocks. Payments company Klarna cut its outlook for a key metric as it expects softness in consumer spending to continue. Baidu's financial performance continued to deteriorate in the second quarter as the company works to remake itself as an AI enterprise. XTI Aerospace, said Scott Pomeroy, resigned as chairman and chief executive amid an internal review of the executive and related corporate governance matters. British retail group Frasers said it now holds almost 48% of shares in Hugo Boss after the acceptance period for its offer expired. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Iranian attacks on shipping in the Strait of Hormuz are piling up without a U.S. military response, raising the risks of crossing the waterway and frustrating some Arab allies who worry the U.S. doesn't have a strategy to wind down the conflict. Trump is pushing aides for a meeting as soon as this fall with North Korea's leader, seeking to again attempt to persuade Kim Jong-un to abandon his nuclear arms program. Trump ally Representative Byron Donalds won the GOP nod for governor in Florida, while Democratic Socialist Angie Nixon scored an upset win in the Democrats' Senate primary, and scandal-plagued Republican Representative Corey Mills lost his primary. Walt Disney's ABC sued the FCC, alleging the agency's efforts to challenge its broadcast licenses and regulate content are illegal and an offense against free speech. Opening statements in a child safety trial against Meta platforms began in what could be the most consequential social media harm case yet. Trump has selected one of his top White House health aides, Dr. Heidi Overton, to lead the FDA, people familiar with the matter said. The U.S. Forest Service aims to open more than 44 million acres of national forest land to logging and road construction, reversing a policy that protected wildlife habitats for decades. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is refusing to extradite a federal officer wanted in Minnesota on assault charges tied to an on-duty shooting during the immigration crackdown in the Twin Cities, a lawsuit claims. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro signed an executive order placing strict guardrails on new data centers, joining several states that are moving to limit the facilities. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said the state wouldn't review or process permits on proposed mining projects in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Zambia President Hakainde Hichilema, the pro-business leader of Africa's number two copper producer, won a second five-year term. A Venezuelan former baseball player working for the San Diego Padres, was detained by U.S. immigration officers after arriving in Texas on a work trip for the club. Died Bill Rasmussen, 93, ESPN co-founder. Frank Beard, 77, ZZ Top drummer. The headline on today's paper is Spacewalkers Take on a Historic DIY Job. And it shows two workers hanging out in space fixing some equipment. Out there, Sophie Ardenat became the first French woman to go on a spacewalk Tuesday. In a NASA image, she and the U.S.'s Anil Menon removed a faulty antenna on the International Space Station. A return spacewalk is needed to complete the fix. Other articles from the front page follow. Iranian ship attacks frustrate Gulf nations as U.S. holds fire. UAE says Tehran hit seven of its ships this month as Trump raises economic heat. By Summer Saeed, Rebecca Feng, and Shelby Holiday, Dubai. Iranian attacks on shipping in the Strait of Hormuz are piling up without a U.S. military response, raising the risks of crossing the strategic waterway and frustrating some Arab allies who worry the U.S. doesn't have a strategy to wind down the conflict. Iran fired two ballistic missiles toward the strait on Tuesday, triggering air defenses in the United Arab Emirates, according to that country's Ministry of Defense, which said the missiles were targeting maritime traffic but fell into the sea. Earlier Tuesday, an Iranian attack hit the engine room of a bulk carrier in the strait east of Oman, leaving the chief engineer dead, maritime security firm said. The UAE said Iran has attacked seven of its ships this month. So far, August accounts for 20% of all attacks on shipping in the war, which is approaching its six-month mark. Abu Dhabi halted trade, commercial exchanges, and financial transactions with Tehran in light of regional escalations, UAE Foreign Ministry spokeswoman said on X on Tuesday. U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. forces in the Middle East, hasn't announced retaliatory strikes on targets in Iran since late July. The U.S. has continued to prevent ships from visiting Iranian ports, however, including firing Hellfire missiles to stop vessels trying to breach its blockade. The restraint reflects President Trump's current strategy to back off military action in favor of tightening economic pressure on Tehran. Earlier in the summer, the U.S. repeatedly launched punishing strikes after Iran attacked ships, prompting Iran to lob missiles and drones across the Persian Gulf. Until Tuesday, the UAE's air defenses hadn't been triggered since mid-July. The skirmishes forced the U.S. and the regional allies to use more of their shrinking supply of defensive interceptors and carried high risks to Gulf energy infrastructure. The White House's change in approach ended a significant escalation in fighting, but it also hasn't persuaded Iran to back down and is raising concerns in the region of an extended throttling of Hormuz amid a drawn-out standoff. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Treasury yields soar to highest since 07. Investors predict a new era in the credit markets, and it looks a lot like 19 years ago. By Sam Goldfarb and Richard Rubin. A sell-off in global bonds is driving up borrowing costs for governments, businesses, and families across the developed world. U.S. bond yields are at 19-year highs, and the Wall Street sees no end in sight. Investors are blaming the rout on everything from the continuing U.S.-Iran conflict, which has stoked inflation worries, to the deluge of tech company bonds vying for debt funds cash. They are also anxious about budget deficits and the lack of clarity from a new Federal Reserve chairman. Few see eye to eye on exactly how much weight to put on any one factor, but most agree on one thing. None of those conditions are likely going away soon. What's more, many see something larger driving the sell-off. The economy's resilience in the face of interest rates that were once considered high enough to slow growth significantly. If the 2008-09 financial crisis ushered in an era of ultra-low interest rates, then current market conditions might mark a return to the way things were before that downturn, some said. Investors are hesitant to buy longer-term bonds because of the risk that rates could move higher, and possibly much higher, even if the Fed doesn't move immediately. Yields on government bonds, which rise when bond prices fall, have reached multi-year highs in recent days, with the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond topping 5.3% for the first time since 2007. The 10-year yield, the premier benchmark for borrowing cost, has also come close to its highest level since early 2025. So far, the sell-off has been limited to bonds. Stocks are hovering near record highs and corporate earnings are still robust, signs that higher interest payments aren't squeezing economic growth. Still, a sustained move higher in yields will have consequences well beyond Wall Street. One of the most direct victims is the government itself, which will be forced to pay higher interest rates on its growing pile of debt as older bonds mature and are replaced by new ones. Even before this year's run-up, interest on the debt was consuming a bigger slice of the federal budget. Now, nearly $1 in $5 of revenue goes to interest payments. Inside the hidden deals that snared Dodgers owner, under pressure from federal investigators, billionaire Mark Walter is racing to save his sports and finance empire. By Justin Baer, Margot Patrick, Joe Wallace, and Andrew Beaton. Mark Walter stunned the sports world in 2012 with a deal that left his wealthy rivals wondering how the chief executive of Guggenheim Partners, little known outside Wall Street, had funded the purchase of the Los Angeles Dodgers, one of the premier teams in Major League Baseball. Few moguls can now claim they aren't familiar with Walter and his international sports kingdom, which spans every season. His playbook, using loans from insurance companies he controls to finance his other investments, is now under scrutiny. In the years after the Dodgers deal, Walter bought stakes in the WNBA's LA Sparks, England's Chelsea FC, and a Formula One racing team, as well as financing the Professional Women's Hockey League. He also accumulated trophy properties, including music impresario David Geffen's $85 million Malibu beach house, and a roster of business partners that includes former Los Angeles Lakers superstar Irwin Magic Johnson and Mubadala Capital, an Abu Dhabi investment fund. Walter, in June 2025, added the Lakers to his sports stable in a record-breaking deal that valued the team at $10 billion. Exactly 3 months later, when Walter arrived on his private plane in Chicago, federal agents served a search warrant, taking Walter's phone and laptop, along with devices from others aboard. The seizures marked a turning point in a federal investigation of Walter's business empire. Authorities have focused on entities that served as intermediaries between the Walter-controlled insurance companies that made the loans and the Walter-controlled businesses that received them. The government wants to determine whether Walter and his businesses committed fraud and concealed those connections. Kids in Chip's startup, valued at $21 billion, poaches NVIDIA talent, by Robbie Wayland, San Jose, California. On paper, Etch sounds like a lot of hot artificial intelligence startups, co-founded by three Harvard dropouts in their early 20s. It has quickly raised nearly $2 billion on the strength of a product that was just an idea 4 months ago. Unlike most of those other startups, however, Etched doesn't make software, but semiconductors, a product category whose high capital cost and long development cycles have relegated it to a corner of Silicon Valley where experience still trumps youthful ambition. Among tech investors, the prevailing wisdom was, "Don't back the kids in chips," said Sonia Wang, a general partner at Sequoia Capital, which led the company's $300 million Series C round. There was a sense that these kids think they can do anything, and maybe on the internet they can, but that in chips, startups are guilty until proven innocent. Now, after a mad rush that included building a mini data center in its offices here for testing, Etched has reached a key milestone, signing up its first customer, Jane Street, the secretive Wall Street quantitative trading giant, for its product, a server rack filled with AI processors optimized for rapid inference computing. The startup has booked more than $1 billion in orders and already started shipping chips. In parallel, Jane Street is leading a new $700 million funding round that values Etched at $21 billion, the two firms said. That valuation puts it above the $2 billion price NVIDIA paid to license the technology and hire the leadership of Grok, a similar startup, in December. The round also includes Kleiner Perkins, Sequoia, Andreessen Horowitz, Tiger Global, Bain Capital Ventures, Neo and Blackstone. The startup said it took just 44 days after getting its test chips back from Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing to have them up and running inference workloads, the computing processes that allow AI models to respond to user queries, a process that usually takes 6 months or more. We may be the only AI chip that was built by a startup that was successful on the first try, said Robert Wacken, co-founder and president of Etched. Leaving the front page, Medicare plans are coming to Costco stores, by Anna Wild Matthews. Costco sells its members everything from travel packages to gasoline. Now the retail giant is gearing up to enter a huge new market, Medicare. The warehouse chain plans a limited rollout of Costco-branded Medicare plans, working with Scan Group, a nonprofit insurer. Nationally, Medicare is a more than $600 billion business for insurers, but the two companies said they would start by selling their jointly named Medicare Advantage products in two states and a Medicare supplement in a third. Scan and co-executives said the three target markets include around 5 million Medicare enrollees, but declined to disclose exact locations or timing, citing regulatory limits on disclosure pending approval by the Medicare agency. Scan is based in Long Beach, California, and Southern California is a core market for the nonprofit, which focuses on Medicare and has about 460,000 members. Scan offers Medicare Advantage plans in Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, and Washington State. Sakeen Jain, chief executive of Scan, said the new Medicare Advantage plans will integrate closely with Costco's offerings across prescription drugs, vision, over-the-counter medications, food, and hearing products. We are trying to create something that's incredibly simple for people to use that will enable them to seamlessly access their benefits, he said. The new Medicare products won't come with a Costco membership thrown in. That isn't allowed under federal rules. The plans will be sold in Costco stores, as well as through normal channels such as insurance agents and websites. Investors slam plan to kill price rule, by Alexander Osipovich. Trump administration regulators are trying to axe a longstanding rule meant to ensure that investors get the best price when trading stocks. Investors aren't happy about it. Hundreds of public comments poured in to the Securities and Exchange Commission in the run-up to a Monday deadline, filed by individual investors as well as Wall Street trade groups, warning that the plan would harm the U.S. stock market. At the heart of the fight is the trade-through rule. The rule forbids trading platforms from executing investors' orders at prices worse than the best available price quoted on stock exchanges. The SEC proposed eliminating the rule in June. SEC Chairman Paul Atkins, a Trump appointee, an advocate of light-touch financial regulation, said scrapping the rule would simplify market structure and reduce cost for market participants. Atkins, who voted against the trade-through rule as an SEC commissioner in 2005, has argued that the rule caused a range of unintended consequences. These include a proliferation of tiny exchanges. There are now 18 stock exchanges, most of which handle less than 1% of total U.S. trading volume, up from 8 in 2005, SEC data shows. Brokerages and trading firms complained they must pay for pricing data from all of those exchanges, even small ones, to comply with the rule. Robinhood Markets told the SEC in a comment Monday that it backed scrapping the rule, saying it costs enforced connectivity, exchange proliferation, and complexity now outweigh its benefits. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, the young mega socialists are here. Many conservatives in Generation Z think the American dream is gone. Some of us are building it. By Emil Barr. 53% of self-identified conservatives under 40 support government-run grocery stores. Not Democrats, conservatives. Take that in. I run a company that tracks layoffs caused by artificial intelligence, and every month I look at spreadsheets that show my generation losing entry-level jobs faster than anyone anticipated. So when the polling says young Americans have soured on capitalism, I'm not surprised by the anger. I am surprised by who is angry, because the risk of socialism among young Americans is no longer only a Democratic story. Young conservatives who grew up hearing that government was the problem are increasingly asking why the government isn't doing more to make their lives easier, which in 2026 simply means more affordable. They are increasingly comfortable with taxing billionaires, expanding government programs, and blaming some outside group for the sense that the American dream is further away than it was for their parents. The left is embracing socialism openly, but we should worry about how the right is arriving at many of the same conclusions by a different route. In a 2025 survey of young likely voters, 42% of conservatives said they would like to see a Democratic socialist win the presidency in 2028. Among 2024 Trump voters, the figure was 35% in another poll. A March 2026 poll found 77% of all voters support raising taxes on billionaires, including 65% of Republicans, 75% of Independents, and 91% of Democrats. It also found 62% of voters are more likely to back a candidate who supports an increased billionaire tax versus 12% more likely to support a candidate who opposes it. These aren't disciples of Karl Marx, but they believe the economy is rigged against them, and they increasingly believe the government should step in and fix it. A July 2026 Fox News poll found that 61% of Republicans view capitalism favorably, down from 72% in 2019, while the share who feels strongly favorable has fallen from 54% to 41%. The share who say the system is rigged toward the wealthy has climbed from 30% in 2018 to 42%. I'm 23, and I understand why my generation is frustrated. Unaffordable housing is one of the clearest reasons. The striking part of Zoran Mandani's win in New York is that the language he used, affordability, rent regulation, hostility to concentrated wealth, now sounds completely normal to millions of young Americans who would never call themselves socialist. I am not going to tell my generation that everything is fine, but I believe we are making a fundamental mistake when we take a real economic problem and turn it into an argument against capitalism. Capitalism is failing young Americans, but it isn't the reason young Americans are failing. On the left, the villain is usually the billionaire or the corporation. On the right, it might be China, immigrants, Israel, or whichever group is being blamed that month for why we can't afford what our parents could at our age. The targets of blame change, but the logic stays the same. Somebody else took what should have been mine, and whoever it is should pay to give it back. This is where the argument gets uncomfortable. Ask young Americans whether they want universal health care, free college, cheaper housing, or more government assistance, and you will find plenty of support. But when you ask who should pay for it, suddenly the revolutionaries get quieter. We want the Nordic welfare state without the Nordic tax bill. We want the government to spend more money while someone charging none of us for it, which sounds more like a wish list than an economic model. I think my generation is getting capitalism completely wrong, because those of us who are actually building companies are showing that opportunity hasn't disappeared nearly as completely as some young people believe. For the first time on record, 2025 saw Gen Z entrepreneurs starting more new businesses than baby boomers, accounting for 9% of new business starts in 2025 against 5% for boomers. Most of those founders use AI to get started. It has never been cheaper to try to be an entrepreneur. So which is it? Are we a generation that believes the government needs to rescue us from the economy? Or are we a generation capable of building our own way out? My mother brought me to America from Russia when I was 3 because she believed that her son would have more opportunity here, and she was right. I was able to scale successful businesses as a teenager, negotiate my way through free college, and build a personal net worth of over $20 million, all before turning 23. I didn't do that because the government handed me a check, but because America gave me room to try. There are real barriers making opportunity harder to reach, and the government built most of them. Housing supply is restricted by zoning. Licensing keeps capable people out of professions they could otherwise enter. Permitting turns projects that should take months into years-long exercises. If those barriers are making life harder for young people, the answer is to remove them. It isn't to convince an entire generation that capitalism itself is the barrier. Capitalism tells young Americans that the answer is to build something, learn a skill, start a business, take responsibility, and create value. The alternative is to be convinced that every economic problem has an external villain and every solution has to come from Washington. That's a dangerous idea, regardless of which party adopts it. Mr. Barr is the co-founder of Flash Pass and founder of Step Up Social. Now for the interest rates from last week to this week. A money market annual yield remains the same, 0.44%. A five-year CD was 1.73%, now 1.74%. A 30-year fixed mortgage was 6.75%, now 6.68%. A 15-year fixed mortgage was 6.16%, now 6.12%. Jumbo mortgages were 6.73%, now 6.71%. A five-year adjustable mortgage was 6.08%, now 6.03%. A new car loan, 48 months, remains 6.98%. The Pepper and Salt cartoon shows neighbors outside having a social hour at someone's property where there is a stream of water going around their land and a duck is swimming in the water. The caption, "We couldn't travel last year, so we decided to build a moat." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 19th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Have a wonderful day or evening.